So this is the creating rich HTML, HTML5 experiences, right? So let's just jump in. We're going to talk a little bit about HTML5, CSS3. We're going to spend some time talking about ECMAScript. For those that don't know, that's just the official standard name of JavaScript, effectively. And then you can't really talk about JavaScript nowadays without talking about jQuery. So we'll spend some time talking about jQuery, especially for those that don't know. And if we get to any part of these demos and you guys already know everything, you guys are familiar with what's going on, raise your hand, yell at me, we'll get through. Because I want you guys to learn the most, right? You guys actually showed up, so let's give you what you guys want to know. So speak up, yell, scream, ask questions, you know. Okay, and then also once we're done with that, we're going to talk a little bit about down-level and feature detection. So what I mean by down-level and feature protection is all these things are great, but a couple of you were talking to me over on the side earlier. You know, this is great, but certain things aren't going to work in certain browsers, so maybe you're stuck in that scenario that we were talking about earlier about having IE7, right? So you can't, you think you can't use these things, or you're not sure whether you can use them because you want it to work for all your websites, or all your different clients, right? All the different phones that people are visiting. So I'm going to show you some stuff how you can actually go out and start using it. So hopefully at the end of that demo, you'll actually be able to take what you've learned here now and then go back to your company and just start converting everything and using all the new cool stuff to make your life easier. And then lastly, depending on time or how hungry you guys are, we'll take it a step further. So I have a couple cool demos that don't necessarily fit into one of these, but are good demos of creating rich HTML experiences or things that you can use to help you create rich HTML experiences. Okay, so what is HTML5? Once again, we have this up here. We use this as an umbrella term quite often. It's basically an umbrella term for vNext of HTML, CSS, and ECMAScript, right? And anything that's kind of included in those. So you can think of SVG, all those. While they are separate standards, they're all kind of grouped in together, and pretty much everyone says, hey, they use the term HTML5 to refer to those types of things, unless they're really OCD about it, and then they might call out each individual one. But for the greater good, everyone refers to it that. Also, this isn't a marketing message. I don't work for the IE team. I don't work for the W3C. I told you I'm not smart enough to be on that board. So this is just me up here talking about cool stuff, stuff that I find cool, and hopefully you guys will find cool as well. So like before, a new standard for a new web. And there's a story I always like to talk about when I talk about HTML5 is when I was growing up, I had what we call in the States America Online. I don't know what you guys have over here that's comparable, but it was kind of the major thing. And it dialed in. You know, I opened up my dedicated America Online browser, and I dialed in, and I had basically their interface. I had no concept that there was any of this other stuff going on in the world, right? Like, I didn't know I could just open up Internet Explorer. At some stage, I was not good with computers, believe it or not. So I didn't know about this stuff. That was the internet to me, right? So I can never imagine that, you know, 10, 15 years from then, I could log on to an Olympics website and stream everything. I think the London Olympics said that they're basically going to stream all the events. So, you know, you're going to be able to view, I don't know, 5,000 different camera angles. I never imagined that I'd be able to do it while I was at work, have it on a separate monitor, streaming the Olympics or streaming basketball or streaming a football game. Or even when I'm out on vacation, you know, I'm out on the lake, on a boat, streaming, you know, live TV, right? I had no idea that this was going to be possible. And the thing is a lot of people that created these standards had no idea that this stuff was going to be possible either, right? These standards were created a long time ago. So the previous versions of all these standards were created a very long time ago. You know, in a galaxy far, far away, if you will. And there was no thought given to these kind of rich experiences because the technology didn't exist. So what had to happen is people kind of hacked around these things. They came up with things like Adobe Flash to allow you to play video and interact more richly with the browser, these kind of plugin-based things, right? So what the W3C is really moving towards is creating that new standard for the new web as they move forward, right? So with that, the thing that I always like to talk about when we talk about HTML is every talk I've seen says, hey, this is HTML5, this is what it is, this is great, but no one actually spends the time to actually talk about why you should care, right? So for me, the reason why you should care is as simple as three S's, right? That's what I come up with. So beyond the fact that some one of your marketing guys came to you and said, hey, I can sell an HTML5 site better than I can sell an HTML4 site. It needs to have HTML5, right? Your boss probably came to you at some stage and said, hey, what's this HTML5 thing? I've heard it on the internet. You know, I need it. Right? Our website has to have it. Go make it. Right? So beyond that, why do you actually care? So with this, is it can do three things for you. And those are the three S's. It can make your markup smaller. So in this particular case, think about the amount of code you have to write to achieve something can be smaller. Think about how much code you used to have to write to play a video or an audio tag previously. Now it's as simple as, you know, including the audio tag, adding a source, and you're done. Right? Much smaller. It can make it simpler. Right? There's no need for you to maintain these complex lines of code that have nothing to do with actually the problem you're trying to solve, right? We want your site to be the best, right? Spend time on doing the, you know, solving the problem that you're out there to solve or providing the service that you're out there to solve. There's no reason you should be maintaining lines of code that add watermark text to a text box, right? That's mundane, that's something not worthwhile. And there's no reason you should be doing that. So it can make it simpler. You can, not only making a smaller amount of code, but also making it simpler. You don't have to maintain those complex lines of code. And then lastly, it can make it more semantic, right? There's a lot of new heuristics built into the standards. And the reason why you care about those standards and making it more semantic is as you make things more semantic, machines can understand them better, right? We can all look at something and understand what you meant to do. Right, so if you put class header on something, we understand as a human as we read that, hey, that's supposed to be the heading for this page. But a robot, so think of a screen reader, or think of, you know, the Bing crawler or the Google crawler, those types of things, they don't necessarily know that, right? They can build these heuristics in, but they can't always get them right. Right? So with that, you can make your life easier. You have to do less work about making, you know, HTML better. And then lastly, with that, you can browsers can make better choices for you, right? So that goes back to the IE side where you saw a lot of time was spent in formatting, right? The more semantics you can build in, the less CSS you have to write, the less formatting the document has to do because it's already built into the document, right? So here's a pretty ginormous map. It's actually like, 100 feet by 100 feet of what HTML5 is. And like we said, it's an umbrella term. So you can see how it's defined as HTML, CSS, web apps, the SVG, the geolocation, the ECMAScript, 2.6.2. And then everything's built on top of that. So the ECMAScript can talk to all these things. And then there's all these new APIs and pieces of functionality, right? So let's talk about HTML5. So particularly in IE9 and IE10, since that's what we just talked about. This slide should look very similar to what you've seen. So this is an example of some things that you can actually do in IE9 today, right? So you can use the new markup in IE9. So you can use the audio video tag, you can use the canvas tag, those types of things. You can do 2D transforms, you can add box shadows, you can write SVG graphics, which is a portable graphics format. ECMAScript 5 is supported. JSON support, geolocation. So all these things are already supported. So most of the stuff you can already use. But we can take that one step further and add all of these other things in. Right? So this is not the combination that's used. This is all just the new stuff. So IE10 actually has more. I know the slide makes it look like it has less, but it actually has more. So now you get things like the file API, WebSockets. Right? The WebSockets is something that's really cool. And we'll touch on that when we talk about Signal a little bit later in this talk. We can do 3D transforms. 3D transforms are crazy. You can do anything to your heart's extent with the 3D transform. Animations, we'll show a little bit of animations. The list goes on and on and on. And then lastly, I would like to give you this piece of information. And it's not necessarily related, but I think it's a cool site, and you should know about it. It's called html5labs.com. This is basically a site that the IE team uses to kind of test their browser as they're building it along. So it basically has really good examples of pretty much everything. So if you're curious about it, you can log into or navigate to html5labs.com. And it'll have samples of here's what IndexedDB, here's WebSockets, here's how you use the file API, all this great stuff. And it'll tell you what browsers, what IE versions of the browsers and stuff like that. And this is actually the website that they use to test as they're building out IE. Any questions thus far? then we'll just move right into HTML5 stuff. So HTML5, if we just look at just the HTML5, so excluding CSS3, those types of things, we're really talking about just the standard, has really two. You can kind of divide the new things up into two bits, which the top, which are all in blue, are new elements, right? So you have things like header, footer, section, those types of things. How many of you have heard of the header and footer tag? That's like the demo, right? Everyone says, oh, I'm using HTML5. I've got a header tag or an H group or those types of things. But then beyond that, there's things that kind of blur the line between element and then also functionality, right? So you can think of figure and figure caption, video, audio tags, right? They're new elements. You put them in your HTML. There's a tag. You put them in there. They do stuff. But then also they provide more functionality on top of just rendering something differently, right? So they can allow you to play a video. They can allow you to draw figures and define information about that figures using the captions, all these really cool things, right? So you can create a diagram and then define, you know, what's going on in that diagram with the figure caption. And there's a much, much more than what's in this list. I just chose, I kind of picked at random all the new things that were out there and kind of just threw them up there, right? So let's talk a little bit. So Canvas is one of those things that I didn't have on there that actually show. It's one of those things where there's an element, but it also provides some functionality. So Canvas basically allows you to draw 2D things on a surface, right? It's a canvas. You can draw circles, squares, those types of things. It's pretty simple. It's canvas tag. You can give it a height and a width. You can define it all in CSS if you want. I just did it here, so it was kind of a self-contained sample. And then you can interact with it via JavaScript, right? This is why HTML5 kind of normally is used as an umbrella term, because kind of everything fits together nicely, right? You really don't use just HTML5 without using CSS3 or without using the new versions of the JavaScript or the new JavaScript API. So you can actually get the context of the thing, and you can actually draw in. You can see here I'm filling in with a color. So I'm doing all red, and I'm filling in a rectangle, right? And the rectangle is going to be those dimensions. It's going to go from those points. Pretty simple. Anyone that's worked with any kind of drawing API before, whether it be in Windows, they're going to be familiar with this. Then there's the favorite one. This is the ooh-ah demo, if you will. Everyone likes the video demo because it's sexy. You get to show stuff. So right now, the spec reads that the HTML5 video uses MPEG-4 with H.264 video encoding. Some of those that might sound Greek to you if you're not familiar with video stuff. It's just the way that the video is encoded and served it up. Think about it like MP3. There's MP4 for audio as well. So it's just a different version of encoding the video and sending it down. And that's kind of what it's coming out to be, is the generic standard. And that'll pretty much play on any device. So I can take it, play it on my iPad, my iPhone, my Windows phone, anything like that. So that's really cool, because one of the problems is, how do you build in decoders, right? So when I send bits down to a browser, how does it know how to decode those bits and actually change them into a video? So it uses H.264. So beyond just the video tag, you can embed this anywhere. So everyone kind of thinks right now that when you use a video tag, it has to be like YouTube, right, where the video is the main thing. How many of you have seen Bing's homepage when there's a video in the background? Oh, not very many of you. OK, so if you're lucky, if you're using an HTML5 supported browser and you go to Bing every day, right, you should be Googling with Bing, right? Everyone is going to Google with Bing. I just made like 10 bucks by saying that a couple times in a row. If you go there, beyond just having a pretty picture every day, that's actually a pretty nice picture, occasionally we'll put up a video. So you'll actually see a video. The stars will be moving. You saw. Before we got started today, there was a IE video, and it had Bing in the background, and you could see the sky moving, right? So you can use these video tags to enhance your site. It doesn't have to be the main content, right? It can just be something that's nice playing in the background as a visual aid or anything like that. So you can interact with all of them, right? So any of that. And then also, it is defined as being hardware accelerated or GPU-based decoding as well, depending on how the browser implements it. So let's talk a little bit about the attributes. Pretty simple. There's a few that you should know about. Obviously, source, which is the H.264 encoded video that you want to play. Autoplay, which is the bane of everyone's existence. You know, I hate when I visit a site and audio just starts playing. In this particular case, when you use like Bing's homepage just playing in the background, that's a good use. So be a good developer and don't play something that's going to get me in trouble at work because I'm playing some video that I should be, I'm watching some video about cats, not actually paying attention in a meeting. So use that carefully. If you have audio, be careful about including autoplay. Other is defining a control. So if you've been to the Bing homepage, there's not actually a control. You can't say play or pause, right? It's just there. It kind of goes on in the background. If you want play and pause, something like, you know, you're on YouTube and you want the play, pause, skip forward, back, volume, all that kind of stuff, you just need to add the controls. You can preload it as well, which means, hey, before I hit play, go ahead and start loading this anyways, because it's probably the first thing you're going to do. Once again, be a good developer. Don't, you know, preload every video on your page. Preload, you know, the first few that they think they're going to click on. And then also loop. Very, 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 very simple. And we have an example of it there. So the other thing is, I kind of skipped over this. Well, I said the browser uses MPEG-4 with H.264, which typically means a MP4 file, which is the video play. Other browsers will support different things. So the OGV is Ogg Vorgas format, and then also people might have heard of the WebM format as well. So what happens, right, as I'm developing a site, and I want to kind of support all the different scenarios. I want to support a browser that may only know how to play Ogg Vorgas, or I really like Ogg Vorgas, so I want that to be the top one, but I want a fallback video in case it isn't supported. You can actually use this source element and inside the video tag instead of adding the attribute. And what that'll do is the browser will look at all the different sources and say, hey, I can play this one. Right? So it'll actually choose the video which it is capable of playing. Once again, audio tag. This is also a very popular one because it's kind of a fancy demo. Once again, thinking about how much code you used to previously have to write to actually achieve this. So you have the source, same thing. It uses the MP3 and the AAC standard for audio encoding. Everyone knows MP3, right? Who doesn't own an MP3 player? Everyone has one, right? Autoplay, same thing. Like I said, be a good developer. Don't just start playing video when I come to your site, especially if you don't give me a control to turn it off, because that'll be the thing that makes me never visit your site again. So let's jump into some demos of some HTML5 stuff. So right now I have Visual Studio 11. This is the public beta, so there's no special bits here. All of this should be available to you if you've gone out to MSDN and downloaded it. How many of you actually have a copy of this that you've played with before, Visual Studio 11? OK, so a few of you. So I'm going to be able to hopefully show you a few things as I go along doing these demos that will actually make you want to go download this and actually try it out and use it. So I want to add a web page first off. I'm just going to do a plain HTML page. If you notice here, we now have some better things. For if I right-clicked and I said add, we now have web form, user control, JavaScript file, style sheet, and HTML. Once again, instead of having to open up a dialog and click through the dialog to select one, we finally have HTML page. How many versions? It took 11 versions to finally get this here. So I'm going to give this a name. I'm just going to call it WebCamp and enter. And I actually want to point out the other thing that was a huge pet peeve to me. So this was a holdover for a few years ago. Previously, in Visual Studio 10, when you created an HTML file, it created as an HTM file from back in the day where you could only have three-letter extensions, right? People don't do that anymore. It's always .html. We finally have .html file. It automatically creates it for you, right? That's a small feature, but I think that's probably one of my favorite features that Visual Studio does. Anyway, so let's actually get writing some HTML. So the first thing I want to do is I want to add a header, right? That's good, right? I'm going to define a header. What I hate when people do is I see people do this a lot. Right? This is an incorrect use of the header tag. Does anyone know why? No. OK, good. I'm teaching people. This is good. The reason being is the header is meant to group tags together. So if you have two or three or four or five or six elements that function as the header of the website itself, that's what the header tag's used for. If all I'm going to put there is an H1, the H stands for header, right? I don't need anything. It's redundant. I don't need two elements. So I can just put H1. But in this particular case, what I want to do is I'm going to put a couple things in here. So I'm going to say this is the main title. And then this, I want to be like a subtitle, right? Everyone's seeing kind of like a blog that has like a little tagline. Right, pretty simple. But I'm going to go ahead and use one of the other elements that's here. Oops. I'm going to actually use the age group. How many have heard or seen the age group used before? OK, so a few of you. That's good, because I'm teaching people things. So the age group, its whole purpose in life is to group together two, and no more than two, no less. So exactly two heading H tags, right? So H1 through 6 has to be two. The whole point of it is to give this kind of relationship between a main title and a subtitle, right? Don't put it there if they're not related. If you want to have something that's like, here's the title of my site, and then also here's the title of the next section, that's not the right use of H tag. It's also not right to just put one H tag in there. It's actually invalid if you do that as well. So I'm just going to consult my group here. And then obviously, I want to include some navigation. Right, pretty simple. I'm just going to do a little li with a little anchor tag here, just so you guys can get an idea of what's going on. Right, that's pretty simple. And let me just consult my notes here. And then I want to go ahead and create a section. So the section tag is kind of used often to group logical units of your page together. Right? You don't just want to go through. One of my biggest pet peeves, actually, is people that say they're using HTML5 or they want to use HTML5. They go through their site, and they find all the divs that they have throughout their site, or all the paragraph tags, and they just replace them with sections. Right? That's not the right way to do it. Right? Section has its own semantic, which means this kind of content is self-contained. Right? So this is a logical unit. And the other question I get a lot of people coming up and ask me in one of the other talks I give, is the difference between a section and an article. Right? So an article is more specific. Right? So you can think of a section as self-contained content. But an article goes one step further and says, this content can make sense outside the definitions of this website. So think about if you're using a blog engine. Right? So you're using a blog, and I post a blog post about HTML5. What you could do is you could print that HTML5 blog post out. You could cut it out, right, and remove all the cruft that says this came from my blog, which you wouldn't want to do because you'd want to give me credit because I'm an awesome guy. But you could. You could remove all the stuff, hang it up on the fridge or hang it up on the bulletin board in your office, and it would make sense, right? Think of it like a newspaper article. If you can't do that, you need to understand the content, or all the content's not there inside the section, and there's navigation and all that kind of stuff, then it's not an article. So you should either consider using section or go back to using div. Another thing I see a lot of people do is they think divs and paragraphs and spans, they can't use those anymore because they have all these great tags. But there is actually a place and a time for a div and a place and a time for a span, right? It's still generic containers, so you still can use those. So in this particular case, I'm actually going to come in here, and I'm going to it also restarts numbering, so you can restart the H1 tag inside of a section. So, and then I'm going to say audio, or some heading, let's say. And then obviously, the last thing that I want to do is, because no HTML5 demo would be complete without an audio or a video tag, I'm going to go ahead and add an audio tag. And if you guys don't notice as I'm doing things, one of the cool features is we now have all the support for HTML5 elements and the snippets, and they're showing up. I get to use those, right? So that's one of the cool handy features. And this particular demo, I didn't have it, so I have a MP3 here that I'm just going to copy in, and I'm just going to put this in the root. Put that there. And I'm going to go ahead and say controls. And I'm actually going to say equals controls. So does anyone understand why I said equals controls? OK. So this is good, learning things. So HTML itself, so if you look at HTML, I could just put a marker attribute. And by marker attribute, I mean like that, right? I don't need that value. But if I want to put that value, that's perfectly fine. And the standard is to put the name as the value for marker attributes. And the reason why you might want to do that, and particularly in this case, is if you notice here, I'm specifying the XML namespace on this document, which means this is also valid valid XML. Right? So this is commonly what's referred to as XHTML5. Right? There was XHTML11. There was all those. Basically, what it means is that it's valid HTML, but I can also parse it with an XML parser, and it's going to be valid. XML says you have to have an attribute value. There's no concept of a marker attribute. So you have to have a value. So in this particular case, because I'm doing that, I want to put controls equals controls. But what I could do is I could just come in here and remove this. And then I could remove that attribute altogether. And one of the cool things about Visual Studio 11, which some of the keen folks might have noticed, is that in previous versions of Visual Studio, particularly Visual Studio 2010 SP1 and later, we had support for validating HTML5 and XHTML5 documents, right? You could come up here to this nice doc type and change it to be XHTML or HTML5 or whatever you wanted it to be, right? The cool thing here is I'm going to go ahead and change this back, and I'm going to wait a second. Perhaps a second. There we go. Takes a second to render, but you can see now it switched back to XHTML5. That's because I had all the decorations required to be XHTML5. So this is really cool because we were previously parsing the document anyways. We already knew what was going on. So why did we make you actually physically go click a button and change it? It was one of those things that no one knew the answer to, so we fixed it. So now you get automatic validation. So if you just write good markup, you declare the HTML5 doc type, which for those that didn't know, is this. That's the HTML5 doc type. It's much nicer because you can actually remember this one, as opposed to if I do HTML4S, this big, long, nasty thing that how many people can remember this big, long? I either had to go look it up or I had to use the snippet, right? So that was kind of annoying. So now we actually have a shorter doc type, which is helpful as well. And just to prove everything works just fine, I'm going to run the site, but I'm also going to consult my notes, make sure I didn't miss anything. Ta-da, it's all HTML5. Everything works just fine, right? I can play the video. In this particular case, it's only 1 second. Or the audio tag. It's a rim shot, for those who didn't get that by the file name. So now we have HTML5. Who learned something there? Somebody had to have learned something. OK, that's good. That's why you guys are here. Go ahead and shift F5. So that was the HTML5 demo. That was kind of a quick and dirty run through of how to use HTML5. And I also showed you some pretty cool features inside of Visual Studio. And you'll see some more. I get really excited about those because there are things that I didn't really know until I saw them that I needed them. So we kind of use this term inside of Microsoft as death by 1,000 paper cuts. So there's the little small things that we're doing to help improve. And then also there's another story that I like to tell particularly around this is, how many of you have heard the fable of the how you boil a frog? Anyone? So basically the fable is if you take a pot of boiling water and you put a frog into it, he's going to jump out. He's smart, right? But if you take a pot of regular water, put a frog in it, and start turning the temperature up slowly, he's not going to know, and he's just going to sit there until he dies, right? The whole idea, the reason why I tell that story with this is not that you're just going to sit in your chair and die if you don't upgrade, which maybe you will, I don't know, but is mainly particularly because there are things that you didn't even know, right? The frog had no idea that the temperature was increasing and increasing and increasing until it just became, you know, dead, unproductive. You don't know that these things were there and causing you problems until you see all the new stuff, and then all of a sudden it's just going to start working for you, right? So that's one of the stories I like to tell with the HTML5 stuff. Moving past that, CSS3. How many of you are, I should have asked this before, how many of you are using HTML5 in your sites right now? Okay. Anyone think they can actually use it after this, maybe? Maybe after we do the demo of all the other stuff you can do. How many are using CSS3 selectors? Probably the same amount that raised their hand for HTML. Okay, so one of the cool things in CSS3 is fonts and font face, right? So how many of you before have gotten this nice Photoshop file, this PSD from a designer that you hired to design your site or your company hired, and then they're using some ridiculous font that you don't even know about, and you have to figure out how you're supposed to get this on the web, right? And you're stuck there, the unartsy, I'm unartsy, I'm willing to admit it, sitting there scrolling through the list of web-safe fonts, trying to find one that looks close enough so that my designer is going to be happy or that I don't have to mess with it, right? That was kind of a pain. So in CSS3, we said, hey, we want to, you know, they basically said, let's find a way to ship fonts with the site, right? The internet's fast. We don't have to worry about download speeds. I mean, to an extent, you don't have to worry about download speeds. You can send these things down. Fonts are relatively small. You could send them down and say, hey, this site's going to use this custom font that I have, right? So this uses the WOLF format, which is the Web Open Font format, and allows you to package up and deliver your fonts down to your site. And then you can actually define a font face, which we'll talk a little bit. It's kind of similar. You'll see this through for these things that you'll want to set the font as something, but that something you'll have to go define somewhere. Is you'll actually use the font face attribute to then basically give it a family name. This is what you'll use when you say font family equals blah, right? You'll use this name instead, and you give it this source URL. Right, so that's a pretty easy way, and you know, you can see that I'm doing that right here. So the next thing is CSS media queries. So how many of you out there knew prior to this that you could have two style sheets? You could have one for your screen, and you could have one for print. Anyone know that? Okay, so a lot of people did. How many people actually used a print style sheet? I'm just curious. Okay, so it's good. That's really good, right? It removes all the images and ads and stuff you don't necessarily need. CSS3 media queries takes it one step further. And allows you to ask the browser about things, right? So we have the standard definition of whether you have all or screen, right? You still have those. But then you have this and more stuff. And what that allows you to do is say, hey, this style applies while the min width of the site is this, right? Or the max width for these styles. So this style will apply until I hit this number. This style will apply until I get to less than 640 pixels, right? You can do that with height as well. So there's a whole slew of these media queries that you can issue asking the browser, hey, what can you do, and applying different styles. And then out of the box, it's called out right here, out of the box, the HTML5 or the ASP.NET project templates, which I showed you were those nice pretty ones, we're using that as well. And I'll show you some more of that towards in my next talk, the ASP.NET talk. Lastly, colors. So apparently, all the cool kids like transparency. Great, so Web 2.0, everything's kind of transparent, rounded corners. It's what all the cool kids are doing. So there's introduced two more ways of defining a color, right? So you had named colors before. You could always just say, red, white, black, you know, safe named colors. You could pass in a hex color, which is the six digits. You could pass in an RGB color or an HSL color. But with this, we've added one more, which is RGBA, HSLA, which are basically just the last A stands for the alpha channel, which gives you transparency, right? So in this particular case, I'm giving it a black, and I'm saying, hey, you're going to be 50% transparent. You can use a one value here, or you could use a percentage as well. And then you could also, HSLA, just different colors, right? So you can use those in and out of the box. But it gives you a nice way to add transparency to your site. So you can add a background color, make it a little more transparent, which allows the user to kind of see through the background as well. So that's kind of handy. Like I said, along with all the cool kids, they're making things transparent. They're also making rounded corners. Rounded corners is something that people liked, right? Visually, the human eye kind of likes a little bit more softer corner than like a hard round corner, as evident by these walls that don't meet at a 90 degree angle. If you've seen the floor, they kind of swoop down, right? People like rounded corners, and it was something that was difficult before. There was no way to do it. You basically had to create an image. I mean, there was different tactics that you could use a JavaScript library, but basically the JavaScript library did nothing more than generate an image on the fly. And you basically got an image for the top left, the top right, the bottom right, the bottom left. Right? And you had all this extra markup and all this extra CSS to allow these. Right? And then once you had an image, what happens if you change the background color? What if the boss came down and said, hey, I actually want a 1 pixel or a 2 pixel, you know, orange border around the element, right? You'd have to go regenerate the images or figure out, you know, is the JavaScript library going to handle the border attribute just fine, anything like that. So I can actually find border radius now, which there's all the different properties, just like there was border. There's border radius, top left. You can dive down into it, but basically this is a shorthand that defines each one. You can give it a border style, and it'll apply the border style, the border width, the padding, all that kind of stuff, and it kind of it handles them much nicer. Whereas if you see these kind of like white lines, that's kind of maybe where you would have had to have chopped it up before to actually create an image, right? That was kind of nasty to have to chop up all those different places to create a nice image just to get that effect. And now you can actually do that just fine in CSS3. Okay, so let's do a CSS3 demo. Let me just consult my magical oracle here. Once again, I'm going to use the add, and we finally have a style sheet here. In this particular case, I'm just going to call it demo. Okay, so let's say every paragraph I wanted to give a nice rounded corner to, right? So I wanted to say each paragraph is now going to have a background color of this. How many people have seen this? Only like one person has seen this. This is a really cool feature. So now we give you a color palette. So anything that requires a color, we open up a color palette. In this particular case, this rainbow is not very interesting because I don't have any colors defined before. But if I was in a style sheet that my company had that had a bunch of already colors defined, you would actually see those at the front, and there'd be a visible divider, which allows you to do is, you know, as I'm coding along in my CSS, I know that there's some kind of red validation color that I'm supposed to be using, but I don't remember that little color. So previously what I used to do is I used to just put it at the comment at the top of the file, and I'd scroll up to the top of the file and grab that color value out, or I'd scroll to another selector where I knew it was at and grab that, right? But in this particular case, it would just be right there, and I can use the keyboard to kind of navigate through. And then the other cool thing is I can go completely down again, which gives me the full-on color picker experience. And the cool thing is we're kind of smart, so right now we're showing black, so we know that we should be using the shorthand, save you 3 characters. For those that didn't know, this just means the first 2 characters are 0, second 2 are 0, third are 0, right? And I can click around, so now we go to the full. And as I change opacity, you can see we go switch to an RGBA, and you can see the transparency, kind of what you'll see in there. And then also, you know, as I go back, we go back to different colors. And then also, if I click the dropper, I can kind of click around. This the dropper thing is my favorite. So as I've been working on the new Azure portal, I get a lot of screenshots from designers saying, hey, we need to make our site look like this, right? But they don't give me the colors, if you will. It doesn't have like, hey, this text is this color. And what the dropper allows me to do is quickly basically click on this, click on an image where it was at, and say, oh, I wanted it to be this color. And it would just, you know, I want it to be this blue color, select it, and now I know what color that is, right? So that's kind of handy. So let's give that a blue background. And then the next thing I want to do is I want to add border radius. So you notice we have that in IntelliSense now, and if we zoom in, the other cool thing is you'll notice it's a little snippet icon, which means we now have snippets for border radius. So why do we have a, let me zoom back out, why do we have a snippet for that? I'm going to go ahead and complete it. So now we have 3 things. So I want to stop here and talk a little bit about why you need these things. Right, so I'm just going to give it a 5 pixel border. What these dash modes, dash webkit, and then border radius is this is referred to as vendor prefixing. And by vendor, I mean browser, right? So anything built on the Mozilla framework, anything built on the webkit, so Chrome and Firefox, right? Basically, what happens is, if you remember me saying that earlier in my last talk, that this standard isn't slated to be ratified until like 2020, and some of the CSS stuff or SVG stuff is even further out. Some vendors choose to say, hey, I kind of want to effectively namespace my selectors so they will still continue to work after. So if they change the name to border radius without a hyphen, you know, it'll still continue to work. right? So we understand that you're going to need to do this. So we include all the vendor prefixes in our snippets as well. Any vendor prefixes that you need will be included in the snippet that are best kind of common practice. And then also you'll notice one of my big things is if you were using vendor prefixes previously in Visual Studio 2010, there'd be green squiggles under there saying, hey, I don't know what this means. I can't validate it. In this particular case, we do know what it is. We can validate it, right? So I can add some border radius. That's kind of handy. Let me just check my notes. Color picker. One of the other things that I really like, I spend a lot of time in CSS, is I just press Control-KC. For those that didn't know, that's comment and uncomment. We spend a lot of time bringing all the validators, or all the editors, so the CSS, the JavaScript, all the editors back up to par in terms of functionality. So I can Control-KC, Control-KU. That didn't work in Visual Studio 2010, right? So we spent a lot of time just making that a little bit nicer for you. And then I am going to copy some stuff out of here, just so you don't have to watch me type. So I've got some markup as well. And I just want to show you an example of what a good media query is. So in this, right below this section, I'm just going to add this div. It's nothing too fancy. It's just a div that says, hey, it's time to get a bigger screen. And in my markup here, I have two things. I have, hey, don't show me this, so display equals none. So by default, it's not shown, right? That's what this is right here. And then what I'm doing is I'm saying, hey, media, only when you're on the screen, so only when I'm actually on a screen, not when I'm printed. And the max width is 800 pixels. So until I get to 800 pixels, apply this style, which is a red color. I'm going to actually display it, and I'm going to increase the font. So if I run this particular site again, perhaps, did I not press? There we go. And I called this, what did I name the file? Webcamp. So I have this file, and you can see right now it's working out. This might not work out so well. Did I refresh it? I think it's actually because I'm running at such a low res. I think the screen is actually smaller, even though it's really big to you. Did you touch success? Oh, no, I didn't. That's why. Thank you. Somebody is on top of it. Once again, you can just drag over the style sheet. Okay, somebody is making me look really bad. Okay, so now if I go ahead and make it really small, ta-da, yay. And then as I get bigger than 800 pixels, goes away. Right, so that's kind of a cool thing. And I'll show you a better demo a little bit later in my HTML5, because you can do some more adaptive rendering with that, which makes your life a lot easier. Okay. Let's go back to the slides. I was a little too far on the slides. Okay. So that's the CSS3 demo. I have some more stuff, but we're kind of a little short on time, so if you want to see some more CSS3 stuff, find me during the break or lunch, and we can talk some more. So, ECMAScript, so JavaScript. Who uses jQuery here, right? Okay, so basically, I assume anyone that raised their hand about jQuery, they're using JavaScript. Is anyone using JavaScript without using jQuery? Okay, one person. Two. What are you guys using? Are you guys using another library or just raw JavaScript yourself? Okay, wow, that's impressive. That's hardcore. I'm not to that level. I'm a little too lazy. I'll use jQuery. So who uses it? There's some really impressive numbers. So you can basically see that pretty much everyone uses it, with the exception of like the two people that raise their hands. Not to make fun of you. It's really good, because some cases you don't need it. Some cases you don't need the full functionality of jQuery. You just need a few little pieces of jQuery here, or pieces of JavaScript here and there to achieve what you need. So pretty much everyone uses it. That's why when I want to talk about JavaScript, I'm just going to talk about jQuery, because it's so ingrained, everyone uses it. And for a long time, the ASP.NET team has been shipping jQuery with our project templates. So right out of the box, you already have jQuery, right? Here's a list of, you might be asking yourself, why, but pretty much everyone is using it already, so you pretty much know the answer to all of these. It's easy to learn. There's loads of plugins. There's a really powerful DOM selection, so a way to select different elements in the DOM. It's lightweight, and it's also community-supported. The cool thing about being community-supported means that they release really quick. So they release every couple of months, which allows them to iterate on new features, or if new things come out for a browser, new ways of doing things come out, they're able to quickly update their library to support those types of things. And here's some links. I included these mainly in the slides so you guys can actually see them later when you download the slides, but it gives you some good information on where you can find it. Basically, this slide is here because it assumes you don't understand how to use Bing or Google, which I assume most of you do. So let's talk about some jQuery fundamentals. We'll go through kind of quickly because everyone understands. It looked like most people knew jQuery anyways. So in this particular case, when I was saying you have an easy way of selecting elements, you can pass in a tag name, you could pass in a class, you can pass in ID, just like you would use CSS selectors. It works the same kind of way. So the idea is that you select something, and then you do something to it, right? It's all chainable. It has a functional programming syntax, so there's a lot of, you know, functions are first-class citizens. Functions are, you know, nothing more. You can assign them to a variable and call them. Right? It's not like C#. So it's more of a functional programming language. So, you know, I can do this open resig thing here, and I can say, hey, when somebody hits click, I'm going to pass in this function that's going to say, hey, I did this thing. Right? Pretty simple. Functional syntax. Everyone hopefully is familiar with functional syntax. Did that go through? There we go. DOM manipulation and chaining. So it's pretty easy to chain all your different events together. So I have a click. Once I did this, I said, here's the CSS container. I appended, and then I also appended on the click. The cool power behind the chaining of events is basically each one returns the same jQuery object, so then you can call something on it again. Right? You don't have to say foo dot, and then foo dot, and then foo dot, and then foo dot. You can just kind of chain everything together. It makes for a really nice syntax. So I'll do a jQuery demo, but it sounds like most of you are already familiar. But I did want to just show you a few little tidbits here that might be interesting to you. So I'm going to take this. Let me just copy some stuff out here so you don't have to watch me type. And I'm going to open this website. How many of you have seen JS Fiddle before? OK, that's good. Not as many people that are using jQuery or JavaScript raise their hands. So you guys should know about this. It's a really cool site that allows you to type in your markup, your JavaScript, and your CSS, and figure out what it's going to do. It's really good for experimenting. So in this particular case, I have my HTML up here. So I'm going to paste in a very simple hyperlink, right, called do something. And I'm going to copy out this. And I'm going to paste this into my script. So I don't need to actually put this in a function, because the way JS Fiddle works, if you read the documentation, it already wraps it in a document create function for you. It'll call it after the DOM has been rendered. Right. So I have a very simple thing that says, hey, when I click on something, run this function. And then this syntax, this is where a lot of people get tripped up in JavaScript. This now switched from the syntax of the browser to the syntax of the anchor tag, right? So I'm basically saying, hey, this is the thing I'm working on. So it'll be the anchor tag that I clicked, and then change the color of it to this gray color. So then I can quickly come up here, click run, and what did I do? Oh, oops. I have a space here, so it doesn't like that. I thought I was trying to render HTML. Or not HTML, because there is a space. So I have this link that I can click on. I can click on it, and then you can see it kind of went gray. It was really hard to tell gray, but it went gray. Right, so that's kind of a cool way. And it shows you JS Fiddle, which is really handy. And then basically it allows you to choose some different frameworks. They have pretty much every framework you could possibly imagine for helping you include all those. And you can include, you know, all the different stuff that's associated with it. And then they take it even further to allow you to have the ability to post up some JSON, and it'll echo that JSON back to you. So you can, you know, test out how you're going to do Ajax programming, those types of things. So this is a really cool site. Hopefully you guys actually use it. The other cool thing, this is actually pretty prevalent if you go to stackoverflow.com. because it'll actually save this. So as you saw that it renavigated, it has a unique ID here, and it actually saves this. So I can copy and paste this to somebody else, and then they basically open it up, and they see my markup, my JavaScript, and they can run it and play around with it. So it's really cool. Like if you're trying to tell your friend how to do something, you can IM a link to somebody instead of just pasting all the code, and then they can actually try it out and fiddle around with it. Hence JS Fiddle. Does anyone want to see anything else? I just assume everyone knows jQuery from this. We're good? Okay. If you're not familiar with jQuery and you want to learn more, find me after the talks, and I'll sit down and show you all the demos I have for jQuery. But I don't want to take up everyone's time because I got other cool stuff to show. I'm not even going to bother opening up the slides or switching to presentation mode because it's only one side. We're going to talk a little bit about down-level and feature detection. So it's probably just best if we just jump right into the demo to give you kind of an idea of what's going on. While this is running, let me... Okay, so I have a very simple site. It's the standard podcast site. Right, so I have a podcast demo. I have an audio player. I can click through my different podcasts. Right, pretty simple demo, nothing too fancy. And I can play, play, pause on the auto. Nothing too major. But I'm going to open up the F12 developer tools. And for those that didn't know, one of the cool features of the developer tools is that I can actually switch which rendering engine IE uses. So in IE9, by default, uses the IE9 rendering engine. But if I come in here, I can actually tell it to use the IE7 rendering engine. Right? And the browser mode, so the difference between browser mode and document mode, browser mode actually will change the user agent that's sent to the server. So if you switch that, it'll appear to the server as if you're using IE7. Right? But if you just change document mode, it just changes the way it renders. It gets everything as IE9. And then just changes the way it renders it, right? So if you're testing, how you want to deal with network calls or those types of things, or feature detection on the server, you might want to switch the browser mode. But in this particular case, you can see, this is kind of really horrible. I have a bunch of HTML5 here. I'm using section, age group, a bunch of HTML5 that now kind of looks not so good on older browsers. And that's fine. I mean, it's nothing to IE7's fault. It's just, these things weren't around when IE7 was created. So what's going on? Basically, because these standards weren't around, these new elements weren't around when the browser started, when the browser came out, basically what we had to do to do performance, if you will, was that a browser had a list of known elements, right? It knew the HTML standard. So it could list any elements that it knew were valid, and then basically it just ignored any other elements. So if we open up, I didn't want to do that, I just wanted to pull it up. If we open up this and we kind of click around, you can see the section is actually just ends up being a self-closed section. That's just kind of ignored. My content is inside of it. And that's because the browser is just ignoring it. Right? If you take nothing away from today but this, I will be very happy. I want you to understand what's going on here. And it's just kind of ignoring it. But luckily, some really smart people figured out that there's ways around this. So in a browser that didn't recognize these things, if you did document.create, which is just a JavaScript function to create a DOM element, and you gave it that value, it would now recognize it and would start rendering it. It understood it to start rendering it. Right? That's great. So what I could do is go into my JavaScript and say document.create and all the new different elements. But that's kind of a pain in the butt. That's a lot of work for me. It's something I don't want to maintain. But what I can do is download a library. So I'm going to go ahead and click on my project. I'm going to manage NuGet packages again. It's again pulling up NuGet. I'm just going to switch to my local repository since it's being a little slow. And I'm going to search for Modernizer. As the name would say, it takes an old browser and makes it more modern. It modernizes the browser. So what Modernizer does is allow the browser to pay attention to what's going on, right? So it does the document.create for you. I've already got it installed. So basically, all I have to do is I have to go to my layout page, right? And I'm just going to copy this line. Oops. Those that didn't know, if you Control-C at the beginning of a line in Visual Studio, it copies the whole line. Really helpful tool. Modernizer, and it's 2.5.3.js. Right. So then I'm actually going to run this site again. And you can see now that I've basically got the same site working, right? So I've got everything. It looks halfway decent. So my DOM elements are being recognized. And if I go in here and I click around, right, I can actually see that stuff's contained inside of here. The problem is, though, is I have an audio tag. IE7 doesn't support the audio tag. So what can I do? The first thing I can do here is inside the audio tag, which is an index, if I just go to the end of the line and just type in something here, when I run this, you can actually see that this shows up now, right? So what it did is it treated the audio tag as a generic container, nothing more than like a div, right? And it'll actually show your markup. So what you can do there is just write markup, or maybe have a link that updates it, or tells somebody that they can't use it, right? But along the, you know, that's not too terribly helpful. What I actually want to do is a little bit more. I want to understand what the browser can and can't do, and then do something based on that. So I have this demo.js file. And this is just included already on the homepage. There's no trickery here. And then also, for those that didn't know, if you drag over a JavaScript file into another JavaScript file, you get this XML comment that's a reference. What this allows us to do is build up IntelliSense inside of Visual Studio. This works in Visual Studio 2010 as well as 11. Basically, this allows us to get jQuery IntelliSense. It tells us what kind of files you're trying to reference in here. So just for a real quick demo, let me get my OpenResig here and go ahead and close that out. And then what I'm going to do is not only does Modernizer fix some of the things, it does a lot of querying for us. So I can say, hey, Modernizer, can you play audio? So the .audio will evaluate to true if it can play audio. In this particular case, I want to say, hey, if you can't play audio, do something. And it actually takes it one step further. It actually asks, you know, out of the three spec'd out versions, so M4A, MP3, and Ogvorgis, which one of these can you actually play? Right? So I could say this and change it or do something like that. In this particular case, for sake of this demo, I could just use, can't type today. I could just use jQuery to find all the audio tags everywhere on the site and then basically just hide them. And I got that error because I actually have an updated version of jQuery, so it's 7.2 when I get IntelliSense. Right? So then if I actually come back here and run this, you can see it went away. I still have the text there, but it's not being shown. It's not even, you know, it's just being hid. And then if I go ahead and switch it to IE9, you can actually see I get that back. So this particular demo is not too terribly interesting because I'm just hiding it. But what you can imagine is instead of just hiding it, you could actually read the source element of the audio tag and replace that with a Flash player or a Silverlight player, right? And there's plenty of libraries out there that will do these types of things for you, right? There's one called MediaElementJS, which will do this for audio and video tags. It'll replace it with a Flash player. And the term polyfill is kind of used to describe these things. It basically takes things that won't work in older browser and makes it easier for you, right? So this is an example of how you can take HTML5 today, start using it in your site, and fix all the problems or the issues with browsers not knowing about elements and then not being able to play video. And then once, you know, you get to a user base that everyone's using a browser that supports HTML5 video, you can just say, hey, I can pull all this code out, and it's pretty simple. It's just remove this JavaScript file. I don't have to worry about it anymore, right? So that's pretty handy. Let's go back to the slides. Any questions thus far? OK, everyone's happy. So let's take this a step further. I'm not going to switch back to the slides because it's just a simple switch. So I have a few things that I want to show you that kind of combine a few things all together, a bunch of JavaScript particularly, to make your life a little bit easier. Or not to make your life easier, but mainly allow you to create rich HTML experiences. So how many of you liked the SignalR demo from the keynote? That was kind of cool. So let's go ahead and I'm going to skip to the SignalR demo, and if we have time, I'll come back to a knockout demo, which I'll talk about later. So SignalR, what is SignalR? So SignalR was created by our team as we were experimenting with WebSockets. How many of you know WebSockets? Okay, so everyone, a decent amount of you have heard of it. Basically, the web works in a disconnected manner, right? I ask the server for something, the server returns me something, and then forgets who I am, basically, right? That's why no one likes managing state in ASP.NET, because you actually have to do it yourself. You have to manage how, that's where view state came about, right? We basically found a way to serialize your state so we could send it back and forth, because the server doesn't know. It doesn't keep you connected. It doesn't understand, right? It just switches you back and forth. You know, it'll answer something, disconnect, and then it'll answer something, disconnect, right? It's kind of like a rude operator, if you will. WebSockets is an attempt to actually create two-way communication in the world. And as we started dealing with these, we took a look. Well, I say we, not me, some people much more smarter than me. We're taking a look at this and said, how would somebody actually go about building WebSockets, right? And one of the problems is WebSockets is very new. Extremely new. In fact, you know, there's really the only thing that's going to support it is IIS 8 moving forward. So you have to have a server that also supports it, right? Not to mention a browser that supports it. So there's very limited browser support, also very limited server support right now. But let's say you did want to take advantage of it. You wanted to play around with it, right? How would you do this? Well, these things typically previously were done by a theory called long polling. What long polling was basically I would issue off an AJAX request, right, as a site. When the site loaded, it sent off an AJAX request to the server saying, hey, do you have any information for me? And that AJAX request would stay open until some information came back. Once the server had something to send to me, it would send the information back. And then I would just issue another request and say, hey, I'm going to wait again until you have something for me, right? It's called long polling. Or another way to handle it is you would just frequently poll. You would just, every 30 seconds, you would ask the server, hey, do you have something new for me? Right? Kind of like an annoying little kid asking, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Right? So these are kind of the patterns that emerged. So the problem with using WebSockets and these types of things is we wanted to take advantage of WebSockets when we had a chance, but we wanted to fall back to something like long polling or even interval polling, or maybe something else. Maybe somebody else could define something else as well. So we wanted to create a framework that kind of helped you do these types of experiences. And that's where SignalR was born. The easiest way to get SignalR is to just go to NuGet, so manage NuGet packages. Once again, we're using it a lot. And I don't know if I have it on my local repository, because I've already had it installed. I don't have it. It's online, but the internet's being a little slow right now, so I actually can't get it. It came back pretty quick. Let's see if I can find it. Yeah, so SignalR package, and then there's a bunch of other packages along with it that you can download as well. But I just have the main package installed, which installs some binaries as well as some JavaScript files, some jQuery files. Right, so we can look at that. Nothing too terrible. Let me just copy some code out here so you don't have to watch me type a bunch of stuff. So I'm going to just create a class file. So I'm going to add new item. And code, class. Let's call this move shape. So this code right here, I'm going to resolve add using. So this code is a hub. A hub is something that, you know, handles communication, right? This is represents a function that I want to expose via SignalR on the client, but this is on the server. So the easiest way to do this is the calling hub name here, which is a data annotation. You give it the name that you actually want to refer. I keep doing that. The actual name that you want to use to refer to it on the client. All you have to do is inherit from hub, and then you can just start coding away to your heart's desire. Right. In this particular case, what I said is every time I call move shape, I want to take in an x and a y coordinate. And then basically, I want to call all of my clients, so all of my attached clients, everyone that's listening, I want to call their moved shape or shape moved function. And I'm going to send it the context.connection ID. This is basically so I know whether it came to me, because I'm part of the client's collection, right? So I can do some smarts there, and then pass it the X and Y, right? So this is the server component of it. And then I'm going to add some JavaScript here. JavaScript file. Basically, what I have here is a move shape JS file. And at the beginning, so I'm saying, hey, give me a connection, give me the hub. So $.connection is the generic thing. And then I want to find a hub. So then I just give it a name. And that's that name that I use in the data annotations. I say move shape. Right? What I'm going to do is get a reference to a shape object that's on the page. I'll show you the HTML here in just a second. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to extend the hub. So I'm going to say, hey, shape moved. So when shape moved is called, this is a function that can be called from a server. So this is me calling it from the server. If you remember from my CS file, I was calling a function called shaped move. This is that function that I'm going to be calling. And I'm going to take in a client ID and an X and Y. And basically, I'm just not doing anything if it's the connection.hub.id. So if it's my thing, I'm not doing it because I've already moved it, right? There's no sense for me to do it. And then the other thing that you have to do is you have to say hub.start. So the first thing you do is you start up a connection. If you don't do this, you'll get pretty much a nice error that says, hey, by the way, you forgot to call hub.start. And then the other thing that I'm doing here is I'm just using the .done function, which says, hey, once the hub has started up, then go do this other thing. And particularly what I'm doing here is I'm just making this a draggable control. So that shape that I have, I want to make draggable. I'm using jQuery UI for that. And I'm going to say hub.move this.offset the values, which basically, this is just a way to say when I'm dragging the shape, this function is called. That's what jQuery does. That's nothing special to SignalR. That's just what jQuery UI does. And the thing is, hey, I'm actually going to call the server, and I'm going to say hub, which is the server, dot move shape, right? So I'm calling that server function from the code and passing it the values that I'm getting from jQuery UI, right? And then lastly, I have to create the HTML file. So I'm just going to create an HTML page, and I'm going to call it move. And I have the code basically here, so you guys don't have to watch me type it all out. Okay, so I'm just doing a little bit of styling here and a block just to make it a little bit easier. I'm just giving a height, a width, a background, and a border just so you can see the shape, right? That's the thing that I'm going to be clicking and dragging around. And then obviously that value, that's the shape that we're looking for, the thing that we're going to make draggable. And then I have some files that I'm including. Obviously jQuery, because I'm already using jQuery and SignalR depends on it. I'm going to use jQuery UI. In this particular case, I'm just using jQuery UI because I wanted to make it draggable. If you're not using, if you're not doing this demo, it's not required by SignalR. I'm going to include the SignalR JavaScript file. And then I'm also going to include my script that I wrote, so my client code. And then this very special SignalR / hubs, right? This is basically a proxy that's generated on the fly, right? It doesn't happen at build time, it just happens at runtime by SignalR. So the server side component of SignalR will actually generate this JavaScript and send it down to the client. Right, so I'm just going to go ahead and run this site. And I'm going to copy this URL. And let's open up Chrome, let's say, just so you can understand that there's no trickery and that it does work. I'll just pin these two side by side. Go here. Right, that's almost instant. It's basically instant. Right. You could argue, hey, I'm running on the same machine, so it's a little bit easier. Obviously, network latency is going to play a factor, right? Like how fast your internet connection is. But the perf numbers on this are actually astounding, right? We do a really good job of actually handling this. And in this particular case, I'm running nothing special. I'm running Windows 7 with IIS 8 server. I'm actually using a dev server right now. I'm not even using, a regular server. So the dev server doesn't support WebSockets. So this is using long polling to achieve its ability. It's basically issuing requests. Saying, hey, do you have anything for me? And if we go into the network tab and start capturing as I do things, you can see here that I basically have request setting just waiting. Right? as I receive things. Stop capture. Right, so is there any questions on the Signaler demo? I went kind of quick. Yeah, question.
Are these libraries included in the Microsoft Internet Explorer 10, or these libraries external?
Okay, so the question was, are these libraries included in Internet Explorer, or are they external? These are external. They're all available. They're actually open source. They're available off of NuGet. You can download them. You can go to, I believe they're hosted on GitHub, and download the files yourself if you don't want to use NuGet. This is something that the ASP.NET team has produced because we wanted to make writing WebSockets applications easier. And it's actually generated a whole bunch of cool demos. You saw the boxing demo with the Kinect. It's generated a whole lot of ridiculous demos. And there's another kind of the de facto demo, which I recommend everyone use. There's a chat room out there that we created as a demo. You might have seen some links flying around. Jabber.net is the chat room, and that's kind of a de facto way. And this is actually uses Signaler for its communication layer with chat. And this is community driven, and we actually use it on our team to communicate back and forth, kind of like I am for chat. Okay, let's go ahead and go back to the slides. So that was taking it a step further. We didn't get to the knockout demo just for time's sake. You guys all look hungry, and I don't want to stand between you guys and food. But if you do want to see some knockout demos, which knockout is basically a way of introducing a MVVM pattern to JavaScript, so a model view view model pattern to JavaScript. It's kind of a cool way of getting some data binding and handling different things. And I have that demo if you'd like to see it. So lastly, this is all the stuff that we learned. Ta-da. These are all the IE blogs, HTML5 demo gallery, which I didn't call out. So the beauty of the web is also run by the IE team that has some great HTML5 demos, some really cool stuff that you can do there along with the HTML5 Labs site.